Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
The Minitel was first launched with a telephone directory. And the advantage was that before, I mean, you just had a local directory. But on the Minitel, you could have the directory for the whole of France and then other countries in the world.
France Telecom decides to shut down the Minitel, France's precursor to the web. Hello, and welcome to Spectrum. I'm Cyrus Farivar in Bonn, Germany, with what's new in the world of European science and technology news. Also coming up, a new website in Latvia merges strong identities through bank information with online political activism.
We don't find any fake signatures ever on there. It's not possible. It's not like you can register three email addresses and then vote three times. It's not like that.
Plus, an interview with a Danish physicist who has figured out a new way to stabilize quantum entanglement. And that could have huge implications for secure optical communications. But first, how about some ice cream made entirely from plants? This week on Spectrum. Although I've complained about the often rainy weather here in Germany this summer, we have gotten a few hot days. And for those of you north of the equator, you've probably been trying to figure out ways to keep cool, too. Many of us enjoy a cold scoop of ice cream on these sweltering summer days, but for the lactose intolerant, the luscious dessert is a forbidden pleasure. And soy ice creams just aren't quite the same as the real thing. Earlier this summer, German researchers announced that they found a way to make a dairy-free ice cream with all the creamy texture of milk entirely from plants. Mark Garrison reports from Freising, just outside of Munich.
So now we are going to our pilot plant facility.
Klaus Mueller is showing me around the Fraunhofer Institute for Process Engineering and Packaging in Freising, Germany. His workplace has everything you'd expect from a high-end research lab. Scientists in spotless white coats and cavernous rooms filled with gleaming, expensive-looking steel machines. But for the purposes of this story, the workplace is effectively the world's cleanest and most high-tech ice cream parlor ever. Mueller, a genial man with a gray mustache, is offering me two scoops of ice cream.
So, now, I hope you can enjoy it, please.
Now, I'm always ready for ice cream, especially on a hot summer day in southern Germany, but before tasting, I need to explain why a world-class researcher wants me to have ice cream for breakfast. As you can probably guess, this isn't ordinary ice cream. Cows played no part in it. It's not even made from soy like non-dairy desserts you may know. Instead of milk, this ice cream is made with seeds of the blue sweet lupin, a common flowering plant. Researcher Klaus Mueller.
Soybean proteins in comparison to lupins are very low.
Because of the blue sweet lupin's high protein content, researchers say it can replicate that creamy consistency of dairy. The ice cream industry has been down this road before, making frozen desserts with soybeans, rice, and potatoes. Kaushik Shankar tracks food trends as a senior research analyst at the consulting firm Frost & Sullivan. He says previous non-dairy ice creams have mostly been disappointing.
The other proteins have a problem with texture, with mouthfeel, and you know, general consumer acceptance.
Klaus Mueller and his colleagues think the blue sweet lupin makes great ice cream. Lupin plants are relatively common in Europe and the Americas. They're tall, thin rods with colorful flowers.
Yes, come in, please. So this is our pilot plant facility for the...
We strapped on hard hats so Mueller could give a tour of the Fraunhofer facility where they turn lupin seeds into ice cream.
We have some pure kernels, and these kernels had to be flaked like cornflakes, you know, very similar.
Processing the seeds into flakes makes it possible to separate the protein in centrifuges. Then researchers can substitute the lupin protein for milk in ice cream. Food analyst Kaushik Shankar estimates the European market for non-dairy ice cream could grow to more than €500 million. Historically, lactose intolerance hasn't been high in Europe, but the numbers are going up as immigrants arrive from Asia and Africa, where lactose intolerance is very common. Lupin ice cream also has appeal for vegans and gluten-free eaters. But as Shankar points out, none of this matters if it doesn't feel and taste like ice cream. And that hinges on whether the protein in blue sweet lupin has what it takes to stand up to milk.
With ice cream, it's absolutely essential that the protein also forms an integral part of the structure of the ice cream. And if they have been able to answer that, then they're definitely looking at a very, very successful product.
So it all comes down to what everyday consumers think about the ice cream in the bowl that Klaus Mueller is encouraging me to try. I may not have a PhD, but I've eaten plenty of ice cream. So now it's time to see if all this science makes good strawberry mousse and vanilla cherry ice cream.
That's actually quite good. I find with a lot of tofu-based ice creams, soy-based ice creams, they have kind of a glue-like texture, and I'm not getting that here. It has a very typical ice cream texture, and in fact, I'm going to finish this. It would be a shame to throw any of this away. Okay, thank you for a special breakfast.
Yeah, you're welcome.
After that, I wanted to see what someone who didn't know that it was made with plants would think, so I bought some at a Munich grocery store and offered it to people. It was not hard to find takers on a smoldering day that topped 33 degrees. First, Tamara, a paralegal on her lunch break, tried it.
I like it, yes.
Later, I gave some to Kai Ennison, who was relaxing in a park with friends. He liked it, too, and didn't notice anything unusual.
It tastes very creamy. It's strong strawberry taste. I like it.
That is music to the ears of the Fraunhofer researchers. People I invited to sample the ice cream were all surprised when I told them there was no milk in it. Granted, this was completely unscientific, but if enough people have the same reaction, Lupin ice cream could be a hit. Four flavors of it are now available in select German stores, sold under the name Lupiness. For those who can't eat dairy and aren't satisfied with tofu frozen desserts, Lupin ice cream may be just what they've been looking for. Mark Garrison, Deutsche Welle Radio, Freising, Germany.
dwworld.de, Deutsche Welle's internet website. We bring you news and views from a European perspective. You'll find information about current affairs, business and economics, culture and lifestyle. You can even learn German with our online German courses. And of course, we bring you the latest program details for DW TV and DW Radio. Deutsche Welle on the internet at dwworld.de.
You're listening to Spectrum on Deutsche Welle Radio. I'm Cyrus Farivar. Remember, if you can't get to a radio when Spectrum comes on in your area, don't worry. You can listen anytime at dw-world.de/spectrum via streaming audio or as a podcast. Both are really easy and completely free to access. You can also see what I'm reading and get a taste of what we're working on between shows on Twitter at dw_scitech. We're at just over 960 followers now, and I would really, really love to hit 1,000 by the end of this month. Please join us. And now, it's time for our new weekly tech feature, Digital Europe.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
Many tech fans know that the World Wide Web was invented in Switzerland in 1989. But before that, France had invented something that was sort of like it, the Minitel, about a decade earlier. At one point, about a third of French households had one of these online computers. It was pretty innovative for the time. In fact, I remember watching my uncle use it once in his country house outside Paris to check the Tour de France scores in the early 1990s. But with the rise of the web, the Minitel's numbers have been falling steadily. And so, just last month, France Telecom decided to shut down the famed service on June 30th, 2012. Molly Guinness reports from Paris.
The Minitel debuted in 1978. It's a boxy-looking terminal, a keyboard and a screen, that connects via a phone line to thousands of different services. It was sort of like a proto-web. Even though the Minitel is decades old, last year alone it reached €30 million in revenue. In fact, there are still nearly 1 million users in France. But the thing is, France Telecom, the company behind the Minitel, says that's been steadily declining since the Minitel's peak in 1994, when it hit 6.5 million terminals.
The Minitel was first launched with a telephone directory. And the advantage was that before, I mean, you just had a local directory, but on the Minitel, you could have the directory for the whole of France and then other countries in the world.
That's Josiane Jouette, a professor at the French Press Institute at Paris 2 University. She used to work at the technological center of France Telecom.
Pour votre Minitel, il y a forcément le service qui peut vous rendre service.
In the early 80s, television advertisements like this one explained how to use the Minitel. In this one, a delighted old man explains to his wife that all he had to do was press the send button to get exactly what he'd asked for.
Pour l'annuaire des services Minitel, tapez 3615.
The Minitel could do much more than look up phone numbers. French residents could check their bank accounts, pay a bill, buy a train ticket, or keep an eye on their stock prices. In other words, many activities that we do on the web today, but years before the web was even invented. In 1982, the French government handed out a Minitel terminal to every household in France. Very quickly, more than 25,000 services emerged for information, e-commerce, and communication. The economic model was simple. The customer paid for the connection, and the money was distributed between the service provider and France Telecom. By the mid-1980s, Minitel usage really took off. One real success in the field of Minitel communication was flirting. The first chat services took off, and dating services and even sex chats became extremely popular. And believe it or not, a few hardcore users are still there. That's according to Philippe Neubourg, who runs the French Computer Museum.
I just connected yesterday, just to try it again. I was on a sexy chat called 3615 Oula, the most known sexy chat in the 80s. And it was amazing because yesterday at 6 p.m., I found more than 100 people connected on the chat.
But beyond sex chats and early online dating, the rise of the Minitel coincided with the birth of the web. French computer experts speculate that part of the reason why the Minitel lasted for such a long time is that France Telecom had invested more than 8 billion French francs, today's equivalent of 1.2 billion euros, in the hardware and the network infrastructure, and it needed to recoup that investment. Again, Philippe Neubourg of the French Computer Museum.
The Minitel was managed by France Telecom, which was not a private company. It was a subsidiary of the French government. And France Telecom was taking back, I think it was 30 or 35% of the telecommunication paid by the Minitel users. So it was a source of money for the French government.
And because the French government and the French people were so committed to the Minitel for so long, it seems that France's uptake of the web was slower than many of their European neighbours.
The Minitel, it's a kind of a paradox, which was, in advance, finally put France behind other European countries and, of course, behind the United States.
But after dragging its feet for a few years, the government and France Telecom changed policy in the early 90s and began installing ADSL communications across the country. France caught up quickly. Now 70% of France is connected to the internet, behind Germany on 80%, but above Spain on 62%. Dedicated Minitel users now have just under a year to use their chat-up lines or buy that last Minitel train ticket. These days, walking through Paris, you occasionally see a Minitel lying on the street, finally thrown out. But many people prefer, nostalgically, to keep their Minitels as a souvenir. Molly Guinness, Deutsche Welle Radio, Paris.
Now, even if the Minitel is going away, online activism certainly isn't. In fact, up in Latvia, a new website called Manabals, or My Voice, lets people petition the Latvian parliament to create new laws. Perhaps it's the recent political turmoil in the country which has boosted the portal's popularity. Earlier this year, the parliament was dissolved and general elections are on the horizon. But the creators of Manabals say the site has a unique design feature that makes it different than most other online petition sites. From Riga, Gators Gelzis reports.
When you speak to the Latvians at the very center of the capital, just beside the old city, they might give you the impression that they are not bothered by the political issues of the country. But the truth is that they are, and it can be seen online.
Have you heard anything about the internet site Manabals.lv?
Oh, yes. It's a project of students. I was there. I have some notes there.
So you have actually voted already?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I know the website. I use it to express my opinion on various important public issues. I think it's a really necessary site indeed.
These are just a few Riga residents amongst the 82,000 people who have visited the Manabals website over the last 2 months and added their support to propose parliamentary bills. If Latvians want to put their question to the parliament's agenda, they have to collect the signatures from the tenth of all the voters who participated in the previous general elections. That amounts to approximately 90,000 people. But the new proposal being considered by the Latvian parliament would reduce that threshold to 10,000 signatures. Though this proposal is still being debated by the parliamentarians, it was the outgoing president Valdis Zatlers who used his powers and handed in a widely supported initiative at the Manabas to the parliament. That new law prescribed to reveal the previously hidden owners of Latvian offshore companies, and the parliamentarians passed the new law after 3 weeks. Any Latvian can submit an idea for a law, and other people can add their name to a petition as a way to show support. But what makes this initiative different than other online political tools is that usernames are tied to their real-world identities. The website checks against Latvian bank records and the national voter registration list to make sure that the political support is actually real.
You don't find any fake signatures ever on there. It's not possible. It's not like you can register three email addresses and then vote three times. It's not like that. It's 100% legit, and we don't have any expenditures on that. Banks provide the service for free just because it's a good project.
That's Kristaps Blaus, one of the founders of Manabas LV. He's a 23-year-old Latvian who also has his own IT company. Blaus says that there is another great tool on the site called Initiative Tracking. That means that Manabas proposals, as they move forward into the parliament, can be tracked by the public. As soon as the idea has been added to the website, the complicated process of launching a petition has begun. Usually, it takes around 6 weeks for the initiative to get published, says Laura Zvejniece, one of the employees behind the portal Manabas.
The majority of petitions published on the site are related to political issues. For instance, there is a suggestion to change Latvia's election system and to retain the people's ballot papers from the general election. There are also petitions against deforestation, for the use of personal names, and even some absurd initiatives, like a proposal to change the national anthem.
Before the petition goes online, up to 15 volunteer experts with a background in law, politics and other areas get in touch with the author and offer their suggestions. Once the consulting is done, the petitioner has to collect the first 100 signatures himself to prove that there is a demand for the idea in the public. When the signatures are there, the lawyers turn the proposal into a proper legal text and make sure that it doesn't violate the constitution. Only then the petition is published and the quest for 10,000 signatures begins. Though this still doesn't guarantee that the initiative will be on the parliamentarians' table at the moment, the political researcher Iveta Kažuok from the Public Policy Centre Providus says that it would help to narrow the wide gap between the politicians and the ordinary people.
This is something that the Latvian political culture has lacked until today, that there is no open discussion between members of parliament and voters. So if they look more closely on what the parliament is doing by following on how their own initiative is being considered there, I think that the trust will increase step by step.
At the present, there are 10 petitions waiting to be signed on the Manabas site, and almost 80 new initiatives are being prepared for the petitioning. Jadars Dielzis, Deutsche Welle Radio, Riga.
And finally today, some news from the world of the extremely small, quantum physics. This is an area of science that can be hard to understand, but it's fundamentally important to the world around us. This is the area of physics that tries to describe the interaction between matter and energy and the dual nature of light, given that it's both a particle and a wave. And that's one of the weirdest things about quantum physics. It's impossible to fully describe particles, things like their location, speed, and spin, at any given moment. And there's another thing that's weird, too. There's this idea of quantum entanglement, which Einstein and other physicists tried to understand going way back to the 1930s. If two systems or groups of particles are entangled, then their quantum states will be correlated. And the other weird thing is, even when these systems are physically separated from another, this phenomenon still happens. Still with me? All right. Now, normally, quantum entanglement only lasts for a very short time, like small fractions of seconds. But earlier this month, physicists in Denmark and Germany have now figured out how to hold this quantum entanglement indefinitely. And that could have huge implications for quantum computing and secure communication. To learn more, I spoke with Eugene Poltsik, the director of the Danish National Research Foundation Center for Quantum Optics. You and your colleagues have just published this new paper setting a new record, in fact, shattering the record for quantum entanglement. Is that correct?
This is right,
okay.
Yes.
Can you explain a little bit as to what quantum entanglement is and what you're trying to achieve through this research?
Well, quantum entanglement, you can sort of translate it as quantum correlations. It usually involves two bodies, and in our case, it's two collections of atoms. And entanglement and quantum correlations means that there are correlations between those two systems which cannot be possibly described by classical physics. Those correlations basically sit within or inside, if you wish, of Heisenberg uncertainty. So Heisenberg uncertainty principle tells us that not everything in the world surrounding us can be determined precisely. There is always an uncertainty. For example, if there is an atomic magnetic moment, atomic spin, the direction of this spin cannot be defined precisely. It is always limited. The precision is limited by the Heisenberg uncertainty. Now, two entangled spins would still, each of them would have quantum uncertainty, but at the same time, they will be parallel. So you can think of the two entangled spins as a superposition, a quantum superposition of all possible parallel directions. So that's the visualization of entanglement.
Okay, so in your experiment, as best as I understand, you have two gas clouds of cesium atoms, is that right?
Exactly, yes.
Okay, and so, and when you talk about spins, of course, you're not talking about the cloud itself, you're talking about the photons or the atoms, or what unit are you referring to?
Well, we're talking, so each atom can be visualized as a tiny magnet.
Okay.
And this magnet, let me just call it spin, so for brevity.
Okay.
And when I have a collection of spins, they can fly around like my atoms in my gas cells, and still each of them will be like a flying around little magnet.
Okay.
So it's those spins that I'm talking about.
So those spins are when you have you have these two separate gas clouds, and when you entangle them, when you bring these two clouds together,
mm-hmm.
then what does that mean?
Okay, so imagine that I have a large collection, two large collections of spins.
Okay.
And let me just
all
say
different
that
or unknown which orientation or.
Let me get to the orientation.
Okay.
So assume that I do my best and I orient all spins in each of those cells along the same direction. Let's say along the north direction.
Okay.
But the quantum uncertainty principle tells me that even if I do my best in orienting them all along the north direction, there will be an uncertainty. Let's say that I wouldn't exactly know that my collective spin, the sum of all spins, points exactly at the North Pole. Instead, it will have a quantum uncertainty, let's say, of the size of Arctica or something like that. You know, the size is not relevant. So it will be uncertain which direction exactly my collective spin is pointing. So this is the quantum uncertainty, which comes from the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Now, if I have two entangled spins, two collections of entangled spins, then those two giant vectors, I still will not know which way they point, but they will be like parallel. So for instance, if I
they'll
measure
be in
one
sync.
Of
they'll
them.
They'll be in sync, basically.
Exactly. If I measure one of them and I find that it's at 88 degrees rather than at the 90 degrees, then I know for sure that the other one is also at 88 degrees. But I cannot tell in advance.
Right. So if you measure it, then you can find out that they're correlated.
Exactly. So this happens also when the two collections of spins, entangled spins, are at a large distance. And this is what Einstein referred to as a spooky action at a distance, in the sense that when I make a measurement of one of the two entangled spins, I immediately kind of do something to the other one, in a sense that I acquire knowledge about the projection of the spin of the other ensemble without even touching it, or without those two spins being in any contact ever since they have been entangled.
How and do physicists understand why this phenomenon takes place?
Well, physicists understand completely explanations of those things within the framework of quantum mechanics.
Right.
So quantum mechanics explains all that perfectly well, but if you want to quote-unquote understand it, then it really becomes bizarre, because it defies like, you know, the everyday logic.
Right. Because there remains in physics this disparity between the laws that govern the macro level and laws that govern the nano level.
Pretty much, except for, let me mention that we are dealing here with like 10 to the 12 power of spins in each ensemble. So that will be a million of billions of atoms. So it is actually a pretty macroscopic object, but still, if you do a good job and look at it carefully and measure it carefully, even such macroscopic objects can be put in an entangled state.
Does that mean then that conceivably, if you're using a quantum system to transmit information, and as you said, to carry, you know, information on the internet, does that mean that the information speeds would be...
No, it is all about security.
Okay.
Speed of information transfer can never be faster than the speed of light. Let's agree on that.
Right.
So it's about security. Quantum entanglement allows distribution of information in an absolutely secure way, which is secured by the laws of quantum physics. In other words, if I have two entangled systems at a distance, I can use this entanglement as so-called one-time pad, to use it as a cipher to transfer my information. And if anybody wants to disrupt this transfer, to eavesdrop, the two communicating parties would immediately learn about it. So this information transfer using quantum entanglement is secure against eavesdropping.
Eugene Poltzig is the director of the Danish National Research Foundation's Center for Quantum Optics. Want to learn more about something you heard on the show? Whether it's plant ice cream or quantum physics, you can always send me a message on Twitter at @DW_SciTech. As usual, we'll have the full version of the interview up at the blog. Check it out at blogs.dw-world.de/spectrum. Anyway, that just about wraps it up for Spectrum this week. From Deutsche Welle Radio in Bonn, Germany, I'm Cyrus Farivar, and thanks for listening.
Universe man, universe man, size of the entire universe man, usually kind to smaller man, universe man, he's got a watch with a minute hand, millennium hand, and a beyond hand, and when they meet, it's a happy land, powerful man, universe man. Person man, hit on the head with a frying pan, lives his life in a garbage can, person man, is he depressed, or is he a mess, does he feel totally worthless? who came up with person man, degraded man, person man, triangle man.